Unstoppable Sound Agency.
Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is the space to find info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. I'm Egberto Willis, and
I'm Laura Barnum. We've got a good show for you tonight, folks. Independent journalist, author, media critic, and experienced activist Norman Solomon joins us for a conversation about the role of journalism, whistleblowers, and the military-industrial complex in shaping the future of democracy. We'll get the ball rolling after a quick public service announcement.
To learn more about corporate personhood, money as protected political speech, and how to get involved with Move to Amend, visit movetoamend.org. Don't forget to sign the petition and join over 400,000 people supporting the We the People Amendment at movetoamend.org/motion. You can also text the word sign to 707-656-4019.
In our movement to pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy for all, it's hard to ignore the power of the military-industrial complex in the United States. The U.S. government spends more than half of our national budget on the military, awarding trillions of dollars in defense contracts to private corporations who go around to spend hundreds of billions of dollars lobbying Congress to increase that military spending. Despite its pivotal role in building our national security apparatus, the connections between corporate rule and the U.S. military are rarely explored within mainstream corporate-owned news. In fact, we're more likely to see corporate media defend the American war economy with nationalist propaganda while coordinating attacks against the characters and credibility of anyone who would dare expose or criticize the dangerous relationship between corporate power and the military. Made Love Got War is how journalist, author, media critic, and activist Norman Solomon describes this relationship in his book by the same name. He's also the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. In addition to his writing work, Norman is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and coordinates its Expose Facts program for whistleblowing and independent journalism. He's also co-founder of RootsAction.org, an online action group that now has nearly 600,000 active supporters. Welcome to the show, Norman. It's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Oh, I'm really glad to be with you all.
Norman, it's really a pleasure having you. Now, look, you were associated with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting for many years before founding the Institute for Public Accuracy and Roots Action. Before we dive into our discussion, first tell us what services these organizations provide and what compelled you to put your considerable talent behind them.
Yes, well, if we take a time machine back to the early 1980s, that really was the environment, the zeitgeist within which the organization FAIR was founded, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And I was, so to speak, present at the creation. I wasn't directly involved in all the hard work, but I was there at a lot of the meetings. And as people talked out the need for a media watch group that would challenge the corporate mainline media. And by the way, although it's a popular way to say mainstream media, and that's one way to say it, I often have come to refer to it as mainline media. There is an addictive quality. There's a manipulative quality, getting people hooked. And so whether we call it mainstream or mainline media, the fact is that in all of our lifetimes, really, corporations have dominated the main information news and flow in the country facts, supposed facts, commentary, and analysis mostly has been, you might say, extruded through the aperture of corporate frameworks. And so if you go back to the early 1980s, you'd be looking at that context with the Reagan administration in power, deregulating like crazy, peeling back a lot of what was left of the New Deal and the regulatory apparatus. And Jeff Cohen, who was an activist, had done a lot of civil liberties work and anti-police repression work in the Los Angeles area, had traveled to Europe and saw that there were some groups there that were challenging the dominant corporate-driven media of the day. So when Jeff came back to the United States, this must have been around 1983 or so, he began to talk to a lot of people about the need for a group that would be media analysis and action. And I think that's very important because it's sort of like walking on two legs. You know, a lot of times we are given information, and that's important, or we're encouraged and given options towards action. But it's really the combination of both so that the action is informed and the analysis is mobilized that's really so crucial. And that's how fairness and accuracy in reporting began in the mid-1980s and has really taken off and, of course, now utilized the Internet. So I encourage people to go to fairnessandaccuracy.org now in, I guess, its 30th year or so. You mentioned that I ended up founding the Institute for Public Accuracy, and really, in many ways, it was an offshoot or grew out of FAIR, because FAIR is really about analyzing the mainline media, challenging the corporate spin, which includes what's on PBS and NPR and supposedly public broadcasting to a large extent. And I saw a need for augmenting that critique and challenge of what is in the news media and what isn't in the media, to provide other voices actively, to fight for and offer other experts who can be heard. And by experts, I mean not only people with PhDs or scholarship behind them, but also independent researchers and activists and people who've walked the walk and talked the talk and know from the ground up what the hell is going on, whether it's in an impoverished area of the United States or under the bombs elsewhere in the world. And so I founded the Institute for Public Accuracy in 1998, and we're 17 years on now, providing lists and quotations and information for sources to about 9,000 editors, reporters, and producers several times a week. And so it's really to augment the range of voices. We say that we want voices to be heard that are not commonly heard in the mass media. And, you know, some people say, are you going to promote right-wing voices as well as progressive voices? And, you know, our response is, Fox News already exists. The right-wing corporate, extreme right-wing has plenty of voices that are heard by tens of millions of people every day by corporate media. We need to begin to balance that out. And so we are, in a nutshell, at accuracy.org, the Institute for Public Accuracy is a pro bono public relations placement agency. We've done work for literally thousands of progressive grassroots organizations, public interest groups in the last 17 years to offer their voices for TV, radio, print, online coverage. And as I say, we're at accuracy.org. And just to sum up, rootsaction.org that I co-founded with Jeff Cohen 5 years ago is an action arm. And we felt that there are a lot of action arms online, even some who are multi-issue like Move On. We felt that they weren't willing to be independent of all political parties, including the Democratic Party. They weren't willing to fight Wall Street. They weren't willing to fight the surveillance state or challenge the warfare state, the military-industrial complex. So that's how RootsAction.org was formed, and I certainly invite everybody to go to RootsAction.org on the web, sign up so you can become part of this action effort that now has included ongoing more than 500,000 people.
Excellent, excellent. Laura?
Because of your own experiences in activism and journalism, Norman, you've become an expert in the way the media is used to sell war. You were among the first journalists speaking out against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and here we are on the brink of another war in Syria. Some would say the U.S. is already at war in Syria. So from your perspective, what's actually going on, and how is the mainline media contributing to Americans' understanding of the dynamics at work in the Middle East?
I've come to really feel that at best, we all sort of aggregate or synthesize our own experiences, you know, everything we can learn from books, film, drama, organizing, activism, interaction, keeping our eyes open. So all of us bring that to the table. And in my own experience, I wanted to be a journalist from an early age. And at the same time, being 17 years old in 1968, I saw how U.S. journalism was being manipulated, utilized, in a sense, ripped off, dominated by the war-making machinery that was pursuing such terrible warfare in Vietnam and elsewhere in Indochina. And so that brought me up short, and I realized that to be a journalist, to be an active writer and hopefully thinker is crucial, and so is activism. And so in the last several decades, I've been involved in some effort, you know, personally and organizationally to have a blend of being factual, doing reporting that has values and that has progressive values that are humane and that really see the need for organizing and activism. If we don't organize, if we don't have groups like Move to Amend, if we don't have groups like so many others that are working across the country and around the world, then the script and the final events will be written and implemented by corporate power, the gazillionaires and the huge corporations. And so to me, it's been both daunting sometimes and yet encouraging to know that it's possible to synthesize what is often put in silos. You know, you're a journalist, you're an activist, you're this, you're that. Well, first of all, we're human beings and we have ways to create change for the better if we're able to do so.
Yeah, Norman, is the 2016 election driving our foreign policy in Syria, Afghanistan, and with Putin? Is that your opinion as it is right now?
Well, it seems we're always between elections and, you know, election seasons are becoming almost every season, you know, to some degree. Of course, as you allude to, it's intensifying. And now here we are towards the end of 2015, the presidential election next year. And unfortunately, I think the momentum of perpetual war has continued. And this is where I think it's so important to have independent organizing groups to deal with reality and not defer to one political party or another. We have had many folks and organizations who challenged the Bush wars during 2001 through 2008. And then as those wars were recalibrated under the Obama administration, all too many folks fell away. And yet in the election cycle, the struggle for messaging, for information, for perspectives and analysis, you might say the struggle over propaganda, has really created tremendous momentum to perpetuate war. And we've seen President Obama, who a year or two ago was saying, no boots on the ground in Syria, no boots on the ground anymore in Iraq. Those boots are in both countries now from the United States. Even more lethally, we have a tremendous amount of bombing that's going on from the United States in many different countries. At last count, from what I could find, seven different countries are being bombed by the United States, intensively, of course, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan. And it's not only the drones, it's other missiles and bombing mechanisms as well. And it has very much been part of the wallpaper of the echo chamber of the 2016 election, where when you look at the Democratic and Republican candidates, there's not one of them who is willing to forthrightly denounce the warfare state or the perpetual war that goes on. Now, the best candidate among the Democrats and Republicans clearly is Bernie Sanders. And I support Bernie Sanders with eyes open. And I think Sanders has tremendous, terrific positions on economics, on U.S. policies, on health care, on fighting Wall Street and corporate power. His positions on foreign policy and militarism are pretty bad. Now, they're not as bad as Hillary Clinton, but that is a high jump over very low standards. And the fact is that even Bernie Sanders is unwilling to challenge perpetual war or the warfare state. And so I guess I'd sum up my answer to say that we have super hawks, all the Republican candidates, with the partial exception of Rand Paul, though he seems to have given up on even talking against war lately. But they're all super hawks. They're just fanatics. They love every U.S. war that we can think of. And Democratic candidates like Hillary Clinton, they're pretty hawkish. And even Bernie Sanders isn't willing to take on the warfare state. So we have a responsibility to widen the debate and to say that perpetual war is unacceptable, that it enriches Wall Street, that it creates tremendous profits for a few corporations and tremendous misery for many people around the world.
Now, based on what you're saying thus far, it seems to me you're pretty much saying, irrespective of parties, that the military state continues, and we're simply just talking about gradation or the appearance of how militaristic we really are.
Yeah, I think that's well put. We have gradations going on of the extremity, how militaristic U.S. foreign policy is, and yet even at best, and you know, this is sort of the good news, bad news. Obama's been the best, or if you will, the least bad president we've had in quite a while. And yet he has furthered the militarization of U.S. society. He has made perpetual war and surveillance and largely shredding of the Fourth Amendment standard operating procedure. He's made it bipartisan, because President George W. Bush initiated a lot of these measures to a great extreme. And rather than Obama coming in and saying, well, this is a Republican program, we reject it, it is not bipartisan, Obama has made it bipartisan. So I think, you know, it's sort of walk and chew gum at the same time. If I'm concerned with abortion rights for women, and I am, I don't conflate the Republican Party candidates and the Democratic Party candidates for president. And I think it doesn't really pass the credibility test for progressive to say, well, it doesn't matter who is president, whether it's going to be Donald Trump or Rubio on the one hand, or Hillary Clinton or whoever for Democrats on the other hand. It does matter. But it doesn't matter enough that we should give up in the slightest the fight for the values we have that are being trumped on by both parties.
Well put, well put. You know, there's one thing I always like to say, and that is President Obama has surely made war a bit more antiseptic, if not more destructive. But right now, we'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
Move to amend We the People Amendment is the only proposed amendment in Congress that addresses both Supreme Court-created doctrine, corporate personhood, and money as speech, the very foundations of corporate rule. Passing the We the People Amendment is the necessary first step in transforming our democracy to one that truly represents the 99%. Go to movetoamend.org/amendment. Read it and take action today.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issue of our time and the nature of corporate rule. We're talking with journalist, author, media critic, and anti-war activist Norman Solomon. As you know, Move to Amend is helping to build a movement to pass the We the People Amendment, which will end the doctrines of corporate constitutional rights, or corporate personhood, and money as speech created by the Supreme Court, which we believe to be a critical first step to establishing real participatory democracy for all. There are many hurdles we need to jump, but large among them is the corporate-owned news, or as I like to call them, the con, which has shirked its constitutional duty to ensure an informed electorate, effectively denying us the right to a free, independent press. We spend an inordinate amount of time unspinning the con and its modern myths so folks can see the myriad connections between the issues people care about and corporate power, particularly around systemic oppression, the lack of a living wage, and a profit-driven campaign for endless war. How do we stop further privatization and consolidation of the media, let alone overcome the breadth and scale of partisan bias within the con?
Well, that's a tremendous challenge right there. And you referred to corporate personhood, which is this terrible meme that has been created and imposed by the corporate structures, including, of course, the corporate media, owned, operated, advertised corporate media, which is, of course, in their interest. And so when we look at the U.S. Supreme Court and their terrible decisions that have established and reinforced and extended this terrible notion of corporate personhood, ultimately it is an entirely political mechanism. You know, the judges are encouraged to tell us, and the media largely tell us, that these are judicial decisions that the justices are making. They're political decisions. They always have been. In the history of the United States, the Dred Scott decision, the Plessy versus Ferguson in the 19th century, terribly racist decisions that were made by judges who were of the time and of the power structure. And yet the same institution, the Supreme Court in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education, came to a different decision than Plessy versus Ferguson, almost 60 years earlier. These are political issues. And what the Supreme Court does is an entire political context. One, of course, is the very mechanical fact that the people sitting on the Supreme Court are nominated by the president and approved by the Senate. So clearly matters who's sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office, who's in the Senate. It also goes to a cultural battle that I think is, you know, sometimes it's like trying to grab hold of some fog. It's difficult to get the mist into the jar and understand what culture is because it's so massive and it's more and more propagated from on high. All you got to do is pick up People magazine or flip through cable channels and you see how the ethic, and I use that term advisedly, of grasping maximum profit is driving what we get and what we don't get on a daily basis in the mass distribution of media. And I think this has so much to do with the culture, the environment that encourages Americans, if not to like it, at least to accept and not fight back against corporate domination. You know, in some societies, you will be taken out and shot if you say something that the leader doesn't want. In societies that have democratic elements, the rulers, I think earlier one of you mentioned the term corporate rule, which is a very, I think, a good term. Under corporate rule, that doesn't happen nearly so much. But what does happen is that propaganda twists and turns through the population because ultimately people who are in power, at least governmentally in power, not Wall Street, need to be elected or reelected. And so what we think, what people think really matters. And that's, I think, why one reason why the battle over media and the need to create our own media mechanisms like this podcast and also to challenge mainline Main Street media that are being so deregulated and corporatized, we got to do that because this is a battle over perceptions and it's a battle for democracy.
That I agree with you 100%. And as you were speaking, I couldn't help but think of this is a pet peeve of mine. It drives me absolutely crazy that you can go to a corporation's Facebook page and like them where retailers are creating friends and these networks of people that are like their Facebook friends. And it is so absolutely perverse in a democratic society that something like that exists. I can't express my disdain for the fact that it exists and that people are hooked into playing that game when there is so much else going on in the world and on the internet that could actually provide productive and effective relief in the to the problems in the world.
Like many people, I watched the World Series, and I consider myself a baseball fan. And it always bothers me to see the Nike swoosh on the uniforms, headbands, the clothing of some of the best athletes in the country. And we sort of take that for granted. And whether it's NASCAR or football or whatever, we've got stadiums, we've got players, uniforms, and other bits of equipment. They're plastered with corporate labels. I mean, I would like to see a move to a men logo instead of a Nike swoosh. I mean, that would be a very different sort of a sensibility. And, you know, if you had a few hundred million dollars, you could make it happen. And so it's for sale. I don't know if you got that kind of money in your checking account, Laura, but this is really the marketplace gone amok. And in fact, virtually everything, almost everything, is for sale and for purchase. And this is a really grotesque way to run a society, which in the long run, of course, is very destructive. And when we look at why is there an absence of adequate, affordable housing? Why is there this perpetual war? Why is there all this pollution of air and water? It's sort of a Zen koan. You can go to all sorts of questions. You can ponder all sorts of uncertainties. And the answers are inevitably going to carry you back to the domination of corporate rule. And I don't mean that everything has to be called capitalism on a large scale to be repressive. There are a lot of different names that are given to things. I mean, in China, they call themselves the Communist Party. It's a very corporate and repressive and centralized apparatus. So whatever the rhetoric, it's corporate rule by any other name. I think the old Soviet Union, you had centralized power in few hands. It's anti-democratic. And the antidote to corporate rule is democracy. I don't think there's really any other far-reaching way to reverse the poison of corporate rule but accentuating and building democracy from the bottom up.
Norman, if you would recall, President Dwight Eisenhower in his farewell speech from the White House, I know you know where I'm going, in the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwanted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Now, an ominous foreshadow of current events, don't you think? Don't you think that is pretty much what has come to pass? Don't you think that is what we're actually seeing right now?
It was a great statement as Eisenhower was exiting the White House at the end of his 8 years in early 1961. And it was a good description then, and as you say, foreshadowed a much worse concentration of power in the military-industrial complex in the many decades since then. It is a good description. And it's really notable that it's so rare for major candidates for office to evoke the specter, the realistic understanding of the military-industrial complex. And Bernie Sanders has begun to refer to it without really challenging or tying in the tremendous interweave of Wall Street and the military contracting system in general. It is our reality. And we've had this uproar in the last 2 years because of the crucial revelations that came from Edward Snowden about NSA surveillance. And when you look at the so-called black budget that, among many, many other things, his documents that he provided exposed, if you add up the CIA and the NSA budget, that's more than $25 billion with a B dollars spent every year. Even now, $25 billion, it's a lot of money. And when you stop and think that the CIA is involved in a lot of drone warfare And both the NSA and CIA are largely privatized. The clearest figure now, 70% of the money that is taxpayer dollars going through the CIA and NSA ends up with private contractors. So just imagine, you know, they're called Beltway Bandits, but around Northern Virginia and Maryland and so forth, around BWI Airport in Maryland, near the NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, there are corporations that have been there for a long time, but also quite a few that sprung up in the months and years right after 9/11. So we're talking, what, something like 14 years ago. And they're
right.
just making a fortune. They're making a tremendous amount of money contracting. And the warfare state, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about, is totally integrated into the surveillance state. The NSA is part of the so-called Defense Department. And when you think of it from a financial standpoint, I mean, it's difficult to run the world, you know. I mean, even for the U.S. government, the most powerful empire in history, you just can't run everything. You know, you may have seen the bumper stickers in various parts of the country, particularly more conservative parts of the United States. It was red, white, and blue. And it said, "These colors don't run," which is an expression of, you know, of course, militarism. And
right.
I saw a much better bumper sticker than that. It was also red, white, and blue. And it said, "These colors don't run the world." But that's a really tough message for Americans to accept. And it's certainly antithetical to the messaging we're getting from the mainline media outlets and corporate power in general. And yet I think that's really a lot of what's at issue. You don't get to run the world, but if you're at the top of the U.S. government, you can order around the CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon. You can do a lot, and you can do a lot of damage, and you can control a lot. But given the limitations, you can't have troops in every country. In large numbers. You can't fight more than two or three major wars. So that's where NSA surveillance comes in, because it's much more cost effective to do what the NSA is doing. Again, through private corporate contracting, they can keep track of literally now several billions of people through cell phones. And that is they're developing real-time capacity, not only to find the occasional person or cell phone that they want to blow up with a drone missile, but more generally to track what people are doing, their communications, their algorithms of email language and so forth. So it's not to get overly dystopian here, but on a realistic basis, we're looking at U.S. government as the most powerful force, which is both governmental and corporate, on the planet. That makes 1984, as Orwell's book, look rather small and quaint.
Actually, that is so right. We are way past 1984 as far as the controls that our corporatocracy has over us, because I don't really consider us having a government. We are corporate controlled, but I don't know how we get around that. We somehow have finally learned that, or we failed to learn that in government, profit is but an inefficiency. One day we will.
Well, on that note, it's fascinating to me the challenge that we face to give a really historical representation of what happened in the New Deal. I mean, here we are 75, 80 years after the New Deal really took off. And you can go around the United States. You'll find roads, bridges, hospitals, libraries, community centers, parks, trails, a fantastic array of what the New Deal left us that's still functional, left increasingly just in disrepair, but also creating well over 10 million jobs in an environment of a depression. And yet there has been always from the beginning an assault on the New Deal from the press barons of the day, the Hearsts and so forth in the 1930s. And it was really in the 1960s that the Great Society tried to build on it. But with the Reagan years, particularly in the right-wing ascension of power, the assault on the New Deal and the principles of the New Deal, of public space, you know, the right-wing view is that public space is wasted space, whereas I think a humanitarian progressive view is that public space is community space, is human space, is a way to make our society and our lives better. And now we've got this tremendous battle to just protect what we have. You know, there was some hope when Obama moved into the White House that he might initiate another New Deal. And I think progressives were way too deferential to the guy. You know, when he put in office in his cabinet some Wall Streeters from the beginning, we should have, from that point forward, said, you know, this is unacceptable and we should have fought like hell. And some progressives did. But I think it's a word to us for whoever is elected. We need public investment. We need public space, and we need to fight privatization because it is really the death knell for democracy.
Norman, I want to jump in for one quick thing before Hannah to tell you that we need to encapsulate that message. It's a very important message that you just stated there, and that is we have to come back to public spaces. And not only that, we have to use the New Deal as the proof for that. When you go back to make that statement that we're still living under a whole lot of the New Deal infrastructure, it proves its longevity, it proves its importance, and it proved that it actually made a way that we're still living on, but that we actually need to move forward on. So, I mean, I think we must encapsulate that message and also get that message out there.
Yes, it's so crucial, and it involves, you know, so much different levels of organizing, of policy formulation, and also of messaging. You know, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, excuse me, in one of his speeches, I think it was Madison Square Garden around 1936, he said that the extremely wealthy forces, the Wall Street, the corporatists, he said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. What a contrast.
Yes.
With President Obama, who says, and I'm paraphrasing here, they hate me and I want them to like me. Well, that's a very different sort of approach. And yes, we would prefer civility when at all possible, but we should not surrender what our values are. And our values are really about the future. You know, whether we have biological children or not, the fact is that the next generations are depending on us. If we don't come through for them in terms of challenging this sort of corporatization and privatization, what's going to be left of the earth, including with climate change? I mean, just climate change is so vast and the implications are so far-reaching that it is the result of anti-democratic forces, corporatization, and so forth. And so that's a challenge for us, that there is no more important challenge.
So we're running out of time, Norman, and I just want to kind of ask one more follow-up question on this military-industrial complex stuff. I go through processes where I try to unpin events in history to see if it will reveal some little toehold where that I can grab onto. And I look at the military-industrial complex as, you know, beginning sometime around, you know, within World War II, the Manhattan Project. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that, to be where they really got their clutches around us. I wonder if that, in fact, is the case. And also, if all of the corporatization and privatization we see is actually a direct result of the military-industrial complex, or are we seeing the privatization of education as a whole separate silo within corporate rule?
I'd say they're very much interweaved, and a lot of corporations are dabbling in many different activities, including, you know, education and propaganda and military. I mean, General Electric had major light bulbs. It was very involved in media investment. The Washington Post, until it was recently sold, also ran the privatizing Kaplan Educational Service, and on and on. And I see this as a progression or a regression. I mean, it's stunning when you look back. Even Walt Whitman celebrated the U.S. war on Mexico in the 1840s. We've got a couple of centuries of really horrific U.S. foreign policy and the genocide against Indians on this continent. And so there's really no golden era to go back to, but the industrialization and the concentration of capital, and then, as you mentioned, World War II, really leapfrogged the United States into the world imperial power. I just found it stunning recently to read a book called The Imperial Cruise about what was happening at the end of the 19th century. Not only the horrific and very avowedly racist U.S. war against the Philippines, but all through Asia, just the white supremacists, there's no better term. U.S. foreign policy, McKinley, Taft, Teddy Roosevelt, who celebrated as a great conservationist, was a horrible racist. And the outlook and the policies and the military actions as the U.S. turned toward the Pacific 120 years ago or so, that was not only terrible and rife with atrocities in its own right, but really foreshadowed to the Vietnam War and to what is going on today in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, in terms of U.S. taxpayer dollars. And it's, of course, there are other malign forces in the world. The United States happens to be the most powerful in terms of militarization, who is bombing, how many people, how often. And that's a tremendous challenge for those of us who live in the United States. If we want to fight corporate power, and I think we must, it's essential to gauge the scope of the problem and do commensurate organizing so that we can prevail.
So true, Norman. So true. Well, folks, let's go ahead and take a station break. We'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
Are you part of a faith or ethical community whose values and principles are being violated by corporate actions? We, the people of the Move to Amend Interfaith Caucus, share in common a variety of values and principles. In this unity, we find the short-sighted and single-minded drive for profits by certain corporations has led to the degradation of the environment and our society. Corporate power has come to dominate our existence, with the values and principles we all hold dear being routinely violated by powerful corporations using their so-called personhood to influence elections, legislation, regulations, and judicial outcomes in their favor and at our expense. It is the purpose of the Interfaith Caucus to engage faith and ethical communities and educate about how the work of ending corporate rule can be approached from a spiritual, ethical, or religious perspective. Working together at national, state, local, and faith community levels, we can pass the We the People Amendment. Join us on our monthly calls the third Wednesday of each month at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit movetoamend.org/interfaith-caucus for more information.
Help raise awareness about the movement to amend the Constitution by hosting your own House Party for Democracy. Invite family, friends, and neighbors for a screening of our mini-documentary, Legalize Democracy. To find the film and learn how to get started with your house party, visit movetoamend.org/houseparties. That's one word, movetoamend.org/houseparties.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we bring you the voices from the movement to amend the Constitution and abolish corporate rule. Tonight, we're talking about the military-industrial complex and what it means for the future of democracy with independent journalist, author, media critic, and anti-war activist Norman Solomon.
President Obama made some promises about protecting civil liberties and specifically whistleblowers during his campaign. And it appears protection for some government workers who report waste, fraud, and abuse have increased. But for workers in the national security apparatus, whistleblowing is being prosecuted more under Obama than all other administrations combined. Daniel Ellsberg became a national hero with the release of the Pentagon Papers and eventually testified before Congress. But Chelsea Manning was sentenced to decades in prison, releasing the Iraq War logs for WikiLeaks. Several others have also been prosecuted and convicted. A couple have gone into exile. Please explain why Obama's security state appears more aggressive in persecuting whistleblowers.
This is one of the worst contrasts between presidential campaign promises and actual policies that Obama has implemented. As you noted, when he ran for president in 2008, there was a lot of nice, lofty-sounding rhetoric about how whistleblowers should be protected and so forth. But once he got in office, he fell into what has been true of virtually all presidents. They don't like what are called leaks of some classified information. But he has pursued the prosecution of so-called national security whistleblowers much more than any other president. As you noted, more than all other presidents combined, using the now 98-year-old Espionage Act as a bludgeon against people who have provided information to the press that the public has a right to know. And I think that's the crucial point. We can't live in a real democracy if we don't know what the people who are in power are doing. And the myth is that somehow, as long as there is the consent of the governed, we've got a democracy. But you can't have a democracy unless you have the informed consent of the governed, and the beat is on the word informed. And what we have right now is, well, consent, at least passive consent, but people are largely unaware of what the government top officials want us to be unaware of. And that's where the whistleblowers jump in. They're vital to democracy. As you mentioned, in 1971, with the release of the Pentagon Papers through the courage of Daniel Ellsberg. In recent years, we've had prosecution, for instance, of Thomas Drake, who revealed some very anti-democratic surveillance, civil liberties violating policies of the National Security Agency. He was threatened with decades in prison, and because he was brave and fought back through the legal system and through the media, including a great article by Jane Mayer in the New York Times, or rather the New Yorker magazine called The Secret Share, he got off with no jail time at all because the government simply couldn't make its case. On the other hand, as you mentioned, Chelsea Manning, now serving 35 years in prison for telling us what we had a right to know about the warfare state and policies of the United States, including what was released through WikiLeaks, the infamous collateral murder video. We should know what's being done in our names with our tax dollars, and we need to know it, and the people in power running the warfare state need just as badly for us not to know it, because they want the uninformed consent of the governed. You know, I am not much of a gardener, and I can't vouch for the truth of this nostrum, but I understand if you want to grow mushrooms, you keep them in the dark and you feed them bullshit. And that's kind of how the people in power view the U.S. public. They want to keep us in the dark. They want to feed us all sorts of nonsense. And then our consent is trumpeted around as though it is actually a form of democratic participation, when actually it's simply being led around by the nose. And so, just to sort of sum up, Obama is at war with whistleblowers. He's overseen the prosecution of many. Most recently to go to prison is a friend of mine, Jeffrey Sterling, who's in prison in Colorado. 3.5 years for being a CIA whistleblower. He went through channels. He went to the House Intelligence Committee and told them about a screwed up, dangerous CIA operation 15 years ago called Operation Merlin. And the fact that he went through channels was used against him in a circumstantial case that resulted in his conviction in January of this year. So the violation of civil liberties is extreme, and it's just disgraceful. Nobody has done more out of the Oval Office to damage the Bill of Rights than President Obama.
Excellent. I call it coarse democracy. But anyhow, why has Congress failed to investigate claims made by these whistleblowers, you think?
Well, there's in the whistleblower laws, I mean, you'll have people like Charles Grassley, a senator from Iowa, who will speak up for whistleblowers about certain forms of waste, fraud, and abuse and so forth. There are some laws that will protect whistleblowers, but there is a cutout for so-called national security agencies. So if you're a whistleblower at the CIA, at the NSA, at the Pentagon, good luck. You're screwed. You're in trouble because these supposed protections that you're going to get as a whistleblower don't exist if you are working for an agency that's part of the so-called intelligence or surveillance or military apparatus. That's what's so outrageous about the claim that Hillary Clinton made in a debate last month when she said that Edward Snowden could have just come back and gone through a reasonable judicial process. That's what happened to Chelsea Manning, thrown into solitary and put on a railroad through a trial. And truly, if Edward Snowden had gone through channels as a whistleblower rather than going public by providing documents to the Guardian newspaper, then his fate would have been very similar to those who are now in prison who went through channels first, such as Mr. Sterling. So we have this mythology. It's really a battle between myth and truth. And you know, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and President Obama and the Republican candidates for president, they all are purveying this myth that somehow Edward Snowden could have and should have gone through channels rather than going to news media with his documents. And it's just preposterous. And now they want Snowden to come back to the United States to go into a trial on the Espionage Act where he would be precluded and forbidden from telling anything about why he did what he did. So they want him to go to a kangaroo court, and thank goodness he's not going for it.
Now, what lessons do you think we should learn or take away from this moment in history relative to all of that we're speaking about?
I think there's a constellation of lessons. There is such a great array of needs for people to be active. I think one of the lessons could be taken from the AIDS health movement in the 1980s with the saying that silence equals death. And just as was true when the AIDS epidemic took hold and was really the destructive flames of it were fanned by bigotry and ignorance, it was silence that was part of death and created more death. And today that's true as well. And so I think a takeaway for us in 2015 and beyond is that our inactivity and our silence will just make things worse. In short term or long term, it creates death and destruction and environmental catastrophe. I've heard people say, and I think this is common, folks will comment, well, I think it would be so depressing to work on these issues. I don't think I could handle it. It would be so depressing for me. And my response is that I believe it's much more depressing to not be active. It's much more depressing to watch straight ahead or out of the corner of your eye the destruction of the environment, the injustice, the warfare, the inequities. That's really depressing because then people feel powerless and passive. And by feeling powerless and passive, and believing that to be ultimately the case, we make ourselves powerless. We make ourselves even more passive. So to me, a takeaway is get informed, get active, work with other people. Nobody can do this by ourselves, but we can do it together.
And that is a great takeaway. I want to go back to Chelsea Manning and for a moment and the collateral damage video. And that kind of video was very common when I was growing up and watching the Vietnam War on the morning news before I went off to grade school. And I think that kind of media coverage that I was exposed to as a child really helped shape and form my political views and who I became as a person when I matured. The fact that, you know, I'm trying to tie this back to the media, and is it really media? Is it the collusion between the media and the government that a great disservice was done when the Afghanistan war and Iraq war happens, and that they embedded journalists as opposed to the kind of journalism we were seeing in during the Vietnam War? Would you care to give us a brief comment on that?
This was terrain and concerns that I addressed in my book, War Made Easy. And I should mention that anybody who is, and unfortunately it is a part of a corporation, but if you have Netflix or some other way to access, the War Made Easy book was made into a documentary film by the nonprofit Media Education Foundation. And people have a chance to take a look at the War Made Easy documentary. You'll see that sort of progression that you're talking about, Laura, in terms of the ways in which media have propagandized for war and how crucial that is. We have seen that to the extent media coverage gets better during a war, it's because of social movements. It's because people organize and from the ground up compel through social change, education, agitation, news media to do a better job, not as bad a job, of covering wars. It was only really towards the last part of the Vietnam War that there was much footage on network TV that began to convey some of the horror involved. And we had notable moments like CBS, a very young Morley Safer, who reported and showed the U.S. troops taking out Zippo lighters and burning down a village. Some of that was shown, but for the bulk of the Vietnam War, there really was not that much on TV about it because it was newspeak, repressive, garbled, manipulative language funneled from the war makers through the stenographic services of the TV networks and news media and out to the public. And it was when people organized and began to build social movements against the war that it got so large from the grassroots, the news media felt compelled to begin to reflect that opposition and to report to some degree better on the wars. So I think that's a lesson for us now. We can't depend on news media because they are overwhelmingly in this country subservient to the manipulation of the people who are running the Pentagon and the White House and the State Department. And again, it's not a coincidence that corporations are making huge profits from wars as military contractors, and the news media are, of course, corporate entities overwhelmingly.
Okay. Let's get back on, over on to this surveillance state stuff. WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Julian Assange sits trapped inside an Ecuadorian embassy in London over the publication of the Iraq war logs. Assange has earned the disdain of the U.S. government for WikiLeaks' constant revelations of secrets, some quite embarrassing and others of incredibly serious and potentially dangerous composition. His story is compounded by Swedish allegations of rape unsupported by witness testimony and for which the statute of limitations has expired. As far as democracy goes, Assange and WikiLeaks are performing quite a service, but two questions remain. Will Assange ever escape exile? And how do we curtail extrajudicial activity within U.S. government institutions when Congress is unwilling to act?
Yes, it's very tough. It's hard to know how long Julian Assange will remain in exile inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I was lucky enough to visit him a couple of times in the last year at that embassy, and it's a very small building. It's only the ground floor. Of course, Ecuador, not a very rich country, and a commensurately small embassy in London. And, you know, he's making do, but it's a very confined, it's essentially house arrest. It's a form of imprisonment, really. And there's no telling how long he'll be compelled to be there. I mean, the only other option at this point is for him to leave the embassy, to be taken to Sweden. As you noted, you know, we all, of course, take sexual assault very seriously, and he should go through the judicial process. He's very willing to do that. He's innocent until proven otherwise, unless he's proven otherwise. But the reason he won't walk outside that building is that the United States is eager to extradite him to the U.S., and the Swedish government refuses to promise to deny extradition and presumably would grant extradition. So he walks out that door, he could easily end up in the United States facing the kind of so-called justice that Chelsea Manning did. And, of course, that's the goal. of the U.S. government. They despise Julian Assange. They want him in prison just like they wanted Chelsea Manning in prison. They got that. They want Assange in the same sort of situation. And it's really notable that Assange is a journalist. Sometimes in the mass media, he'll be compared to Daniel Ellsberg. He'll be compared to whistleblowers or called a whistleblower. And certainly it's an honor to be called a whistleblower or to be compared to Daniel Ellsberg, but it's the wrong comparison. Chelsea Manning is a whistleblower. Chelsea Manning is comparable to Daniel Ellsberg. Julian Assange is a journalist. Julian Assange is a publisher, an editor. He is comparable to the New York Times, if we're going to talk about the Pentagon Papers.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Why not the New York Times? So please, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it goes to how willing and able these media outlets are going to transgress against the power of the U.S. government. And it sort of, I guess it goes to your other question as well. I mean, the judicial system is so permeated with political power, there's no way to separate it. It's not a justice system. It's a political system in the judiciary. And so we've got these various ways that the power structure, the corporate, the military, the governmental, can lean on and intimidate various media outlets that are themselves largely corporatized. I sat through the trial for 2 weeks of Jeffrey Sterling, the CIA whistleblower, in January of this year, and one of the key witnesses against him was Condoleezza Rice. And she recounted how she had a meeting in the White House in April of 2003 with the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, Jill Abramson, and the reporter, the excellent reporter, James Risen. And she recounted that she read off talking points from the CIA to tell them that the New York Times must not report on Operation Merlin, the CIA operation that Risen had gotten information on. And over the objections of the reporter, Mr. Risen, the New York Times, within a week, sent a message back to the White House and said, okay, we won't publish. And in fact, never published information about Operation Merlin. And it was only because Risen published it in a book that the public ever found out. And then Sterling, as a whistleblower, allegedly the source, although he said he's never been that source, he went to prison as a result. So it all goes, you know, it's sort of, and people can quote de Tocqueville or Thomas Jefferson or Karl Marx or whatever. I also like to quote Lewis Carroll in Through the Looking Glass, where Humpty Dumpty is asked by Alice, how can you make one word, question is, she says, how can you make one word mean so many different things? And Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who has the power? That's all. So take it from Humpty Dumpty. Who has the power is really a crucial question.
Well, we'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. We're talking with journalist, author, media critic, and anti-war activist Norman Solomon.
Now, Norman, in an October Huffington Post article, Ruby Mellon reports that Purdue University, which maintains a defense contract with the U.S. government, recently deleted a presentation by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Barton Gellman's discussion of the surveillance state. His presentation was live streamed and was to be made available through a link at its conclusion. However, the presentation included copies of leaked classified information. Yet, Purdue, the first public university to adopt a free speech policy condemning the oppression of any idea, no matter how offensive, unwise, immoral, or wrong-headed it may be, withheld. How intertwined has the military-industrial complex become with higher education?
Yeah, that's a really important and key question. If you go back to what happened just after World War II, you had many scientists, of course, some of them had been hyper-jump-started through military programs, including the Manhattan Project, and many of them went back into private industry or into universities, whether public or private universities. And the U.S. Navy in particular and other military services, they got out the checkbooks, and they began to subsidize programs in colleges and universities across the United States. And so there were a lot of physicists and other scientists and researchers who wanted to do their work, but they found that the money to do the work was tied in with military contracts, not just nuclear weapons, although that was very big at the University of California, but also all sorts of other endeavors, including chemistry and various forms of physics and biology and so forth. And they found themselves, wittingly or not, working on well-paying, well-financed university jobs that were being subsidized by the Pentagon and were sometimes in joint contracts with private corporations. And, we're living in that legacy right now, and so much of the funding of universities is tied in. There's also another factor, which is that those who are contributing money, the alumni and so forth, often very wealthy corporate entities are giving money or not giving money to universities based on what kind of programs they have, what kind of teaching departments they have, the kind of politics in those programs, and, as you said, public events as well. So, shame on Purdue for being so willing to censor. But unfortunately, this is not uncommon in various forms.
Now, you said it's not uncommon in various forms. I think you identified this as bona fide censorship. Do you have any other examples of anything like this happening?
Well, we've been encouraged to believe that censorship only comes when there's a dictator, a commissar, somebody who says you will print this, you won't publish that. But in fact, censorship comes in many different forms, including corporate, including in an academic setting. I would give an example at Ithaca College in New York. There was an article published in the Alumni Magazine about the suppression of Palestinian rights, and all sorts of hell broke loose after that with wealthy alumni putting pressure on the college at that point. There I was, I spoke in Connecticut at a prep school, and I met with a faculty member who said that he almost lost his job by bringing in one speaker who discussed the human rights violations of Palestinians by Israel. Now, that's one high school, one prep school, and one speaker, and that was considered absolutely unacceptable. There have been various efforts to legislate in California against allowing people at the universities to speak in favor of a boycott of Israeli products, and that's being equated with anti-Semitism. So in that realm alone, and there are many others, there's a strong tendency of the powerful to want to, as the saying goes, it's free speech for me, but not for thee.
I wonder if the growth of privatization throughout the country, and in particularly the way that the taxation, taxation goes down, privatization goes up, and the fact that education in general and institutions of higher learning in particular have experienced such great budget cuts in the last decade that this corporate money actually is required to some degree. And, it all seems like a big plot to me.
Well, it's structural. I think it's, you know, you could say it's worse than an individual plot. It's a structural plot, if you will. That's the way it's structured to maximize profits. And you could draw a parallel between the schools with the charter schools, the public schools, the universities, and so-called public broadcasting, because first, the CPB, the corporate parallel, you've got corporate money, and then you've got CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is basically government-funded. And as that money has been provided, it's often been with political strings attached. You have politicized people running CPB, appointed by the president and so forth, by Congress. And you also have people who are running these public broadcasting outlets, TV and radio, PBS, NPR affiliates, and they are soliciting money from corporations. And so it's sort of a vice, these public outlets. And we're talking about, you know, hundreds and hundreds of PBS TV stations, hundreds of NPR affiliate radio stations, and they're getting CPB money, which is politicized to a significant degree, and then they're getting corporate money. And it's a form of privatization, and they're, of course, asking for money from the viewers and listeners as well. But the sensibilities, I mean, let's be blunt, a lot of what's on PBS is just terrible stuff. I mean, FAIR, the Media Watch Group, has documented how, you know, there are years where you have so many shows about wild animals, and you don't even have any shows about poor people in the United States. I mean, it's pathetic. On broadcast radio, public broadcasting, you have the PRI program Marketplace. You don't have a Labor Place program. I mean, you stop and think. When was the last time you heard a program that was focused on labor and labor rights on national public radio? It simply doesn't exist. And yet on public radio, we're getting daily Marketplace. It's funded by corporations. It's about corporations. It's largely from the point of view of corporations. And that's another insidious form of privatization.
In our effort to pass the We the People Amendment, part of Move to Amend strategy involves empowering others by giving them the tools and resources they need to become organizers and help educate their neighbors at the local level. What tools and resources are you using and recommending to mobilize people behind policies addressing the root causes of our economic, social, and environmental problems?
Well, I think it's a crucial educational, organizational, and organizing process that Move to Amend is involved in, and I hope people will continue more and more to avail themselves of what Move to Amend is providing online and in other forms. I've been involved very much with the Institute for Public Accuracy, and so we put out now close to 300 news releases a year that have a lot of content in them, and people can sign up to receive them on an almost daily basis. And it's often related to breaking news. So we're striving to provide information below the news, beyond the news, that is glossed over, omitted by mainline media, so that broader context can be created. And I think that's a challenge. You know, there's a lot of junk and disinformation and corporate-driven information on the Internet, but there's a lot of terrific sources as well. And we have that opportunity to avail ourselves of the information, and very much in the context of organizing, which I think is crucial.
We believe corporate personhood and money as protected political speech to be at the heart of maintaining corporate power, the root cause of most of the problems we're dealing with. Do you see an intersection between the work of Roots Action and our work to pass the We the People Amendment?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, at rootsaction.org, we're very supportive of a constitutional amendment to end corporate personhood, and we very much see the need to fight corporate power at many different levels. You know, the way in which it is part and parcel of militarization and vast pollution and climate change and inequity, injustice, redlining, racially imposed discrimination, and so many other ills. So very much what Move to Amend is doing and what RootsAction.org is doing, very much we're working in the same garden in much the same way.
That's great. That's good news, because it's all about movement building and making connections and finding solidarity with one another. I look forward to Move to Amend and Roots Action working together in the future.
Me too.
Norman, before I go forward, I want to pick up on something that you said before, and I think it's rather important because you mentioned something about PBS, and this falls into the big picture. You noted that whereas we have Marketplace on PRI and other more business-oriented programs, there is nothing from labor. My question to you, and I don't know the answer, is labor not being sufficiently aggressive to ensure they have a place on something that is supposed to be a public, somewhat a public space, the airwaves?
Well, labor, of course, is in a very disadvantaged overall political and economic environment, and whereas you had close to 40% of the workforce unionized in the United States in the middle of the 20th century, it's now down to about 12%. That said, I think that labor has simply not given the kind of resources and priority to media that it should. There was an abortive attempt about 10, 12 years ago of the AFL-CIO to put funding into a radio talk network. It was, I think, ill-funded, ill-run, and, you know, very disastrous results, you know, very sad results. And it, just the money is not there. I mean, and it should be there, given that the AFL-CIO still has tremendous resources and should be, I think, establishing its own broadcast sources and not buying radio stations, but providing radio programming for free that could be picked up around the country. So being sort of long-winded to say, yes, I think that labor unions, especially the ones with major resources, have really been remiss in failing to develop their own outreach beyond their own membership, or even to their own membership sometimes, to get the message out on a daily basis. You got to show up every day. You got to provide media and information every day. And it's not enough to simply sign on to the Democratic Party and send out emails. That's not going to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, it is that's where I wanted to get to, because it is my belief that whereas the corporatocracy surely knows how to use the media, you and I and many others, we are here attempting to do that. I think it is important that somebody get the message to those guys that it is important that messaging actually gets, you know, that we actually get the message right, that we actually get the narrative right, because it is something that just is not currently happening.
Absolutely. I think that's right.
We have one final question. And what we'd like to ask you is, we know that you're into a whole lot of things right now, but we'd like to get people to know who you are. So why don't you give us some information as far as how people can reach you? What are you currently working on that you want people to reach you about? And how do we move forward from here?
Oh, yeah. Hey, well, thank you. And first, I want to say it's been great to talk to you, all of you, on this podcast of Move to Amend. And I certainly hope that people will redouble their support for Move to Amend. I should mention that there are a few websites I'm pleased to invite people to visit. One is my own, normansolomon.com. That's NORMANSOLOMON.com. And those are my latest articles and some background material. Also, accuracy.org at the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is now in its 18th year. And we're, as I say, at accuracy.org. You can sign up for almost daily updates in terms of news behind the news, context behind breaking news. And also rootsaction.org. That's rootsaction.org. You can become part of this action arm that now has more than 500,000 folks. We're able to develop petitions and direct email actions and others to pressure members of Congress, wardens of prisons, polluting corporations. We're doing a lot of that. And one more I'll mention, which is called exposefacts.org. And we're supporting whistleblowers. We're advocating for them. We're doing investigative journalism. were looking for documentation of malfeasance and various corporate crimes. And so people are invited as well to go to our website at exposefacts.org. And of course, please go to the Move to Amend website, and maybe I can ask you in turn to let people know how to go there.
Well, absolutely. Please go to movetoamend.org and sign our petition. But look, Norman, it has been my pleasure. It has been our pleasure to have your wisdom on our show today. So we know that we're going to have you again. But again, thank you very much for spending this time with us.
Oh, well, thanks to you all. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, I want to add my two cents in as well. It's been great fun and very enlightening having you here, and I look forward to your return performance. That's it for this edition of Move to Amend Reports. Good night and have a great week.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, and Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, with the assistance of Renee Babcock, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.